Morning, folks, or afternoon. If you're here, you must have finished your quiz, right?
Yes, sir.
Hey, so clearly the quiz is still live, so I won't mention anything about the quiz, but you should be able to check your scores and the solutions probably in about 4 or 5 hours. I've set it so that I give a reasonable window. So kind of hold off on, if you're curious, you'll find out soon enough whether you're right or wrong. But today I'm going to complete our discussion of betas, cost of equity, and start in the discussion of debt. So before I get started, any questions? No, okay. So if you remember last session, I left off talking about Disney's beta. Now, the way I got Disney's beta is I said, I don't trust a regression beta. That's where it started. So if you remember, we ran that 5-year regression of Disney, and I said, I don't trust that beta. It's backward looking, it's noisy. It doesn't reflect the changes that have happened to Disney over the 5 years. So what I'd like is a forward looking bottom up beta. And the way I got that was I broke Disney down into 5 businesses. Actually, Disney broke themselves down into 5 businesses, which kind of helped me. Because to get the beta for Disney then, here's what I did. I went and found publicly traded companies in each business, use those publicly traded companies to come up with an unlevered beta for each business. I call this a pure play beta, but again, don't let the terms get in the way. It's a beta of being in the broadcasting business, in the movie business. And the last table I showed you, I took those unlevered betas by business and weighted them by how much value Disney gets from each business. Let me emphasize the word value. Not revenues, because that's a shortcut. I converted the revenues into value using that enterprise value to sales ratio, just a fancy way, or really a simplistic way of converting revenues to value. So based on my looking at Disney or my numbers, it looks like Disney is 49% broadcasting, 34% theme parks, about 14% or 13% movies, and then you got consumer products and gaming. The weights obviously have to add up 100%. So if you ask me what the unlevered beta of Disney's operations are, my answer is it's about 0.92. It's a weighted average of those unlevered betas. Now, if you think about buying Disney, the company, you buy shares in the company, you're getting Disney's operations, but you're also getting Disney's cash. You're saying, so what? Well, cash is a beta of 0. So if you ask me to go an extra step and say, hey, tell me what the beta for Disney's entire balance sheet is, not just the operation, but also the cash, I'm going to bring cash in based on how much cash they have. And the unlevered beta I'd end up with would be slightly lower. But the beta you should focus on is that 0.9239, because that is the beta for Disney's businesses. Any questions on that process? So you can see for some of you, when you do your, so let's turn your attention to your company. In the project. When you try to do this for your company, some of your companies are single business companies. If you have a single business company, you just get a beta for the business, you're done. No, nothing to wait because it's single business. But if you are in 2 or 3 or 4 businesses, take that extra step. Estimate the value of each business, the weights of each, and take an unlevered beta, which is a weighted average. Now, ultimately, though, when you think about equity, it's not the unlevered beta you care about, it's a levered beta. So let's talk a little bit about what that levered beta is and what do I need. I have the unlevered beta. Normally, if you look at the equation to get the levered beta, I need a debt to equity ratio, right? Sam Pollack, when you want a debt to equity ratio, since we are fresh off the quiz, everybody should know the answer. Do I want a market debt to equity ratio or a book debt to equity ratio?
So ideally you want a market.
Ideally, we'd want a market. And yeah, go ahead. But you're going to qualify that with?
No, I'm saying for fixed income, sometimes it's harder to get a market valuation.
Okay, so you might use book debt and market equity with the argument that book debt is roughly equal to market debt, but you're still aspiring for a market debt to equity, right? Let's see why this is going to become an issue at Disney. I can get this for the whole company, right? Getting a market debt and market equity, or even a book debt and a market equity for the whole company is going to be easy to do. And I started with that. And I'll take you through the process of how it came up with these numbers. But based on the whole company, the debt to equity ratio for the company is 13.1%. So that's how much debt and equity the company has. But I'd really like to know the debt to equity ratio of each of their five businesses. Why? Because I need a debt to equity ratio for each business to come up with a beta for that business. And here I ran into two problems. The first is, I don't know what the market value of equity is of the broadcasting business and the theme park business, because they're not publicly traded. The company is traded, but the businesses don't trade. So I don't know the market value of equity. But you think, but you at least know how much debt is used in each business, do I? When you open up Disney's balance sheet, does it break debt down into this is how much debt is in the broadcasting business? It'd be nice if they did, but they don't. So to show you how I've evolved on this number, from complete laziness to partial laziness, this is the fourth edition of my book. The first, and Disney's been in all four editions. The first edition, the late 90s, I got to this point. They were in five businesses then as well. Very different. They were slightly different, but five different businesses. I had only a debt to equity ratio for Disney as a company. And I said, you know what? Since they don't tell me how much debt is each business and I cannot estimate equity, I'm going to give every business the same debt to equity ratio. It's laziness because I'm saying, but even as I did it, I knew that this was probably not right. Why? Because the movie business is very different from the theme park business. The amount of debt you might use to make a movie is going to be very different than the amount of debt you might use to build a theme park. And I was giving them the same debt to equity. So I've been struggling with doing this better. I'm not sure I got to a final iteration, but in this version, here's what I did for the debt. I said, look, I don't know how much debt Disney has in each division, but they give me some clues. In fact, they have this breakdown by business of what they call identifiable assets, which are physical assets. So if you look at their annual report, they said, these are the identifiable assets in each of the five businesses. I made an assumption and I could be completely wrong. I said, companies tend to borrow money for these physical assets. So if you can tell me how much assets you have in each division, I'm going to allocate the total debt that Disney has based on those assets. So if you look at the breakdown of debt, basically what I've done is I've allocated the 15. So the only number I know is the 15.96 billion in debt at Disney as a company. I'm breaking it down by division based on those assets. I'm almost home because now I have the debt for each division. If I can somehow get the market value of equity of each division, I'd be home free, right? And I estimated the market value of equity. And here's what I did. Remember on the previous page, I'd estimated the value of each business by multiplying revenues by enterprise value. So if you took, for instance, the broadcasting business, the enterprise value that I got for the broadcasting business was 66.58 billion. If they have 6.07 billion in debt, the difference between those two numbers has to be equity. So for each business, I take my estimated value, I take out the allocated debt, I come up with an equity, and magically I now have a debt to equity ratio by business, and it's different for different businesses. It's different for different businesses because some businesses carry less debt than others. In fact, what surprised me was the consumer product business happened to have the highest debt to equity. And the case of Disney, that actually makes sense. I have a licensing business, they can borrow a lot of money. The licensing revenues are pretty stable, but I now have different debt to equity ratios by business. So I have the unlevered beta by business. I have the debt to equity ratio by business. I use that debt to equity ratio to come up with a levered beta by business. So I have a levered beta for Disney as a company. That was easy. I took the unlevered beta, I used the debt to equity ratio for the company and came up with a levered beta of close to one. But I now also have a levered beta by business. And take a look at those levered betas. They range from a low of 0.75 for the theme park business to a high of 1.25 for the movie business. Intuitively, that makes sense to me. You walk into Disney head, yeah, go ahead.
Isn't the high 1.5 for the interactive business?
Oh, I'm sorry, you're right, 1.5, I missed that. The highest is actually the gaming business. And that makes sense to me. If you walk into Disney Burbank and you look around, there is no way you can tell me that every business that Disney has is equally risky. I've now reallocated the risk and come up with different betas for each business. And since betas are my pathway to cost of equity, I now have a cost of equity for Disney as a company, 8.52%. but I also have costs of equities for each of the five businesses, ranging from 7% from the theme park business to 11.6% for the gaming business. By using bottom-up betas, I've created a way of coming up with costs of equities, not just for the whole company, but for each business in the company. They said, why do I need that? I'm going to give you a very simple, you know, case. And I want you to tell me, based on what I'm going to tell you as in the case, what you would use as your cost of equity. Remember, the cost of equity is what you need to make on a project to break even. So you ready? You be Disney CFO. I'm going to pick somebody here. Robert Peterson, you're going to be Disney CFO. I'm going to be the movie guy at Disney. I'm very unreliable. You know how movie guys are. You know, they just make decisions off the top of their head. So you're sitting in your office, minding your own business. I bust open the door. I come and say, hey, I've got a big budget movie we should make. And you say, what? Say, Lone Ranger 2. This time we'll do it right. Tells you something about Lone Ranger 1. I mean, who thought this was a good idea to make Johnny Depp into Tonto? When you see Johnny Depp, you know, I don't know about you, but every time I see Johnny Depp, I think drunk pirate. No matter what he acts in, he's a drunk pirate to me. But that was a disaster for Disney. They spent $260 million making the movie, and they made like $35 million back. They had to write off the bulk of the movie. Already you're getting ready to shut the door in my face and say, no, no, this time we've looked at the numbers, which tells you a little bit about last time, but let's not go there. So I've hired three MBAs, they've come in, they've crunched the numbers, and I think they, you know, we can make a return on equity of 9.5% of the movie. No movie guy ever uses the word return on equity. But let's say I'm the movie guy who does, 9.5% return equity. You see why I picked 9.5%? Go back to the previous page. What's the cost of equity for Disney as a company? 8.5%, right? 9.5% is higher than the company's cost of equity. What's the cost of equity of the movie business? It's 9.9%. So I'm offering you a project that makes more than the cost of equity for the company, but it's less than the cost of equity of the business that the project is in. This is perhaps the biggest mistake made in corporate finance. Let's see if you can avoid it. Alex, you help me out. When I have to decide whether to take the project, should I take the project by comparing it to the cost of equity for the company, or should I compare to the cost of equity for the movie business? And I'm going to push you. Once you make the choice, I'm going to push you further. Go ahead. What do you think, Alex?
I would say no, because it's lower than the cost of equity for the business.
You'd use the cost of equity for the business. So you'd say no. Mm-hmm. Okay, let me play devil's advocate. But we're all part of the Disney family. Disney's cost of equity is 8.5%. You know that half of all company, you actually were right. You should be comparing to the cost of equity of the business, but half of all multi-business companies in the world use one corporate hurdle rate, one of the stupidest mechanisms I've seen. Because if you pick one corporate hurdle rate, then this project passes muster, right? It's higher than the 8.5%. But you know what will happen if I take this project using that hurdle rate? If I decide to use 8.5% as my hurdle rate, if you go back to the previous page and you look at the five divisions, which divisions are going to be delirious about this choice? Like, this is amazing. And which divisions are going to push back? Just give me a breakdown of divisions. Which divisions are going to be happy about using one corporate cost of equity, and which divisions are going to push back?
Ones with higher than 8.5 are going to be happy. And the ones with
the gaming business, the movie business are going to, this is amazing. And all the safe business are going to say, this is so unfair. And they're absolutely right, because you know what you've just done? You've subsidized your risky businesses because you have safe businesses. And over time, you know what's going to happen to the safe businesses? They're going to shrink and die. Your risky businesses are going to get bigger. 5 years from now, when I look at Disney, it's going to be a riskier company because it's overinvested in its risky businesses. the first rule in multi-business companies is you have to have hurdle rates that vary across businesses, with riskier businesses facing higher hurdle rates. Any questions?
Professor, I do have a question on the previous slide. So the table at the top, when you did the value minus debt, estimated equity, so the one at the bottom for Disney, so you didn't just sum up the ones at the top,
no,
right?
Because because with Disney, I actually had the numbers for the company. So I didn't do the estimate because I actually have an actual number. For the five businesses, I had no choice, right? And in fact, have you ever heard of sum of the parts valuation? Analysts like to act like it's some big deal. I've just done a sum of the parts valuation of Disney, because if you add up those valuations that I got for the five businesses, I've got a sum of the parts valuation of Disney, and it doesn't match up to what the market's actually attaching. So when I did Disney's debt to equity, I used the actual numbers, but for each of the divisions, I've used my estimated numbers. Now, why do you think companies are so reluctant? I mean, this is common sense to me, right? Because what are we saying? If there are multi-business companies, each business has to carry its own weight. Riskier businesses should earn a higher return because they're riskier. Safer business should be allowed to get away with a lower return because they're safer. So why do you think companies are so incredibly resistant to this idea? Because, you know, half of all companies are breaking, and this is one of the first rules in corporate finance, and it's got enormous consequences. Why do you think companies are so reluctant to use business-specific or division-specific hurdle rates?
Well, in Disney's case, the studio entertainment is sort of the engine that drives the whole company with merchandising and things. So they might argue that it could be a loss leader.
Brian has a very good point, which is, you know, at least in the case of Disney, they can say the lines between the businesses are gray. In other words, if I have a huge movie hit, the theme parks benefit, right? Because I've got a Toy Story Land in Disneyland. So one of the reasons they might give is really these are not divisions. We're really one business. And that's a sensible reason. That might make sense for movies and theme parks, but then it gets, and now it's streaming, you can make the same argument. If Avengers does really well at the movie theaters, I get three spin-offs. So one good reason might be the division lines are not clearly drawn. And with Disney, maybe you could get away with that. But United Technologies, which owns Otis Elevators and Sikorsky helicopters, what the heck is your rationale for saying, if I get in an elevator, I'm going to buy a helicopter? The two don't even go together. So that's actually a sensible reason. I'm willing to debate it, but that can't be the reason for companies that are truly in many businesses. What else do you think could be stopping them? How do most companies get their betas? How do most analysts get their betas? Michael?
Historical.
And they run a regression. If the only way you get betas is with the regression, you're trapped, right? You get only one beta for a company. I remember at the peak of GE's glory, there were people using GE's beta for every single one of its 26 businesses. Absurd. But they were doing it because they said, what choice do I have? I have only one beta for GE. So one is the fact that you get betas from regressions. You know, the second problem is, anytime you're a multi-business company and you start talking about having different hurdle rates for different businesses, all hell breaks loose. And some businesses don't like the idea at all. And you're going to see in a minute which businesses. About almost 30 years ago, one of the students from this class went to work for The Gap. And this was when The Gap was a growing company. It had just started two new divisions. The original Gap was the same investment over and over, right? Another Gap store, another Gap store, another Gap store. Every store was a mall store. They all looked alike. And The Gap had a hurdle rate of 18% on its stores. And then it decides to open two divisions. One was Banana Republic and the other was Old Navy. So this is right after they opened the two divisions. I get a call from the student. He was in the finance department in group at Gap. And he said, hey, we're planning to open these two new divisions. And you all, you know, at least walk by. I mean, most of us don't go into any Gap stores anymore. That's why the Gap is collapsing as a company. But you walk by a banana republic and you walk by an Old Navy. Let me actually ask you intuitively, remember what we said drives beta is how discretionary or non-discretionary a product is? If I asked you to think about betas, and I gave you three divisions, Gap, Banana Republic, and Old Navy, just put them in order. Which of these three divisions should have the highest beta and highest hurdle rate? And which ones would you expect to have the lowest beta and the lowest hurdle rate? Rank them for me. William Clements?
Sorry, I would say Banana Republic, then Gap, then Old Navy.
Banana Republic is just Gap clothes marked up 30%, but you don't have to deal with the riffraff. Old Navy is Gap clothes marked down 20%, but you deal with a lot of riffraff. So depending on how much you're willing to deal with people, basically, and we talked through this and we all agreed that we should have the highest hurdle rate for Banana Republic. Gap should be in the middle. Now, we never talked to exactly what number, but we said, and he said, no, I'm going to bring it up at the divisional head meeting next week because we're bringing them together and we're going to talk about hurdle rates. I knew exactly the buzzsaw he was walking into, but I didn't have the heart to tell him. I said, why don't you call me back after the meeting and tell me how it goes? So a week later, he calls me back and he says, the meeting did not go well. I said, what happened? He said, I brought up this idea of having different hurdle rates for the three divisions, but one of the division heads absolutely hated the idea. I said, let me guess. And you could probably guess. Which division head do you think happened to hate the idea? The Banana Republic, I said, this is terrible. You know, this is so unfair. Why are you asking us to make 21%, whereas Old Navy makes 15%? I said, what did the CEO do? He said, well, for the moment, he really wants Banana Republic to grow. He likes the division. And he decided to put it off for a couple of years. This process plays out in multi-business company after multi-business company. You know who the worst culprits in this game are? It's banks. In 1981, Bank of Strasse was a traditional commercial bank. And over the 80s, it played a really stupid game where it took commercial banking and investment banking and asked them to compete for equity and said, whoever has the higher return in equity will get the equity. And guess what? Investment banking beat commercial banking every single year because they're riskier and they're higher return businesses. By 1990, Bankers Trust had become almost all investment bank. JP Morgan in the late 90s got a moment of good sense, and they actually tried to impose different hurdle rates for different parts of JP Morgan, from private equity to commercial banking to investment banking to real estate. After 3 years, they still hadn't had closure because divisional heads were so absolutely opposed to having different hurdle rates across businesses, even though everybody understood that this was the sensible thing to do. And you know how it played out? In 2008. And played out in 2008 because banks got into riskier and riskier business without demanding. There's nothing wrong with lending money to subprime borrowers. You know what's wrong? Charging them too low a rate. And if you're not requiring a high enough return, you're going to be overexpanding in risky businesses, not demanding a high enough return for being in those businesses. And when those businesses blow up, you're going to say, what the heck happened here? This is fundamental. And I want to make sure everybody's on the same page because this is an argument you will probably have to make no matter where you go to work, on why different projects might need different thresholds to be acceptable. Any questions before we?
Hey, Professor.
Go ahead, Cody.
Examples of companies that are breaking out their betas?
There are multi-business companies that are doing it much better, but the way they get there is through pain. And it happens because things blow up. I'll tell you, but 15 years ago, I was at GE, and this was when GE was a glorious conglomerate. And they asked me to come in and talk to their divisional heads about risk and return. And I said, GE, you probably have different hurdle rates for business, right? Not really. We're a big company. We get away with the corporate hurdle rate. And if GE was not thinking about it, you can see why many other companies don't. I mean, they're a 26 business company. If they're not doing it, a three business company is probably not even going to try. Jeremy?
So if companies are trying to have hurdle rates mm-hmm. for different divisions, is there a best practice of how they would allocate the debt internally? Like you just guessed, and I would assume
they should have better ideas, right? I mean, in fact, within the company, they shouldn't be guessing. I mean, clearly, you know what you borrowed the money for. So I would think that within companies, that process of allocating debt should be much simpler. And if it's not, you should start to put into place practices that earmark where the debt is going. It's easy enough to do. So I think this is a process. It might not happen overnight, but if you start thinking in these terms and say every business has to stand on its own feet, because what we're trying to prevent is cross-subsidization, where risky businesses live off the fat that comes from safe businesses. They borrow based on safe businesses. They take projects based on safe businesses. And safe businesses can subsidize only so long before they go out of business. So I think that this is something that companies, if once they start thinking in the right terms, have the information. In fact, they have much better information than you and I in making these allocations. Michael?
Just to play a little devil's advocate, obviously it makes sense to allocate per business with its respective hurdle rate. But if you're requiring the same hurdle rate, the same overall corporate hurdle rate, so that means, you know, the safer businesses you're going to require to actually do better than you would have, you know, if you would break it out, and the higher ones you would require to do a little, you know, less good. Wouldn't it even out over the, you know, your expectations even over the whole corporation?
You know what the flaw in your rationale is? That corporate hurdle rate is somehow going to stay fixed over time, right? So let's suppose that I beat the corporate hurdle rate by taking more and more risky projects. Initially, the market might not know. They said, this company is great. Look, it's delivering returns higher than its cost of equity, but the way I'm doing it is by entering risky businesses. At some point in time, will markets start to notice I've gotten into riskier businesses? Sure, my price is going to get riskier. My earnings are going to get more volatile. So there might be a period we can fool a lot of the people, a lot of market participants and look good, but eventually your risk catches up with you because this isn't just an abstraction, a calculation, it's a real risk that you're kind of pushing off into the future. Daniel?
I have a question about Disney's parks and resorts beta. I would think that would be highly discretionary, but it looks like that's a low beta. Can you explain that?
Do you have any kids, Daniel?
No.
Let's say you have a five-year-old and you say, no, we're going to Disney next year. The minute you say that, you know what it's become? Absolutely non-discretionary. You might delay buying a car. So in the abstract, it's discretionary, but because it caters to that subset of our population where they're not quite rational. And that's what's made COVID so difficult, right? You promised your three-year-old you're going to go to Disney in 2020. That's a really tough task. But I think you're in the right path, thinking about discretionary, non-discretionary. But in this particular one, it turns out the theme parks, because of those, and you can't just say, look, you know, we'll go to the Six Flags, just like Disney. Right? Six Flags might be discretionary. It's, one roller coaster ride is much, but Mickey is not. Now you can dress up as Mickey and say, no, he's come home, so you can go to Six Flags now. So I think it turns out to be much less discretionary than you think it would be. Carlos?
Yeah, I guess to understand, with the exception of the kind of banking recklessness you mentioned just now, right, wouldn't some of this be on the lenders? Like you could have whatever cost of equity you want, but you're going to go to a bank. Wouldn't you hope they do the analysis based on the line of business?
They take care of their what's the lender's interest? Just making sure that their interest payments get made. It's not their job to figure out. So you could still be a money-making company. You're just not making enough money given the risk you've taken. Your stock price will be down, but you're still making your interest payments. So a banker will never protect equity investors because that's not his job. And to try to shuttle this off on bankers will mean that you can end up being exposed as an equity investor.
Got it. Thank you.
So let's talk about, any other questions on Disney? So let's talk about Vale. I'm not going to go through Vale in the same detail that I did Disney because it's going to bore you. It's the same process. Vale broke themselves down into four businesses. Metals and mining, iron ore, logistics, and fertilizers. They're a Brazilian company, but I didn't stick with Brazilian companies as my comparable companies. I went global in all four businesses because let's face it, metals and mining and iron ore are mining businesses that are global. And the advantage of going global is my sample size is really big. Take a look at how many companies I was able to find. 48 metals and mining companies, 78 iron ore companies, 693 fertilizer companies, 693. Why? Because there are 46,000 publicly traded companies in the world. And I did exactly what I did with this. I computed the average beta, corrected for debt, unlevered the beta, cleaned up for cash, came up with an unlevered beta by business. And then just like with Disney, I took the revenues that Vale got from each business and estimated what value each business has for Vale. So based on my estimates, Vale looks like it's 76% iron ore mining. So that's its biggest business, followed by metals and mining, followed by fertilizers, and then logistics. You know, the other advantage of getting betas by businesses, Vale actually sold off its logistics business about a year after I did this. Let's say you've been hired to value the logistics business for sale. How do you value business? You take cash flows, you discount back at a rate of return that reflects the risk of those cash flows, right? You know what you'd use as your cost of capital for the logistics business? The beta that you computed for the logistics business. This now gives you the capacity to value pieces of businesses because you're valuing each business based on its cash flows. So I've got the beta for each business. And as with Disney, I computed a levered beta. And here I cheated. I cheated because these are all big infrastructure businesses. Unlike Disney, Vale gave me no clues about where the debt was, no identifiable assets by business. So I thought about it for a moment and say, why am I wasting my time? These businesses all probably borrow the same amount of money. And here I did use Vale's debt to equity ratio for each of the business. What I'm trying to say is there's no one template. If you're looking at your company and you cannot figure out an intuitive reason why debt should be different across businesses, I'm okay with you applying your company's debt to equity ratio for each of the businesses, coming up with a levered beta and a cost of equity. And in this case, I've computed the cost of equity for Vale's four businesses, all in US dollar terms. And we'll talk about what to do if you want to switch currencies. And you can see the cost of equity for the four businesses are different, but they're not very different. Vale, unlike Disney, is not in businesses that are wildly different in terms of risk. The businesses tend to be much closer. So Vale could probably get away using a corporate hurdle rate and not be hurt much, but it's still breaking the rules. Any questions on the Vale beta? So same process, break businesses down, get the unlevered betas by business, estimate the value of each business, take a weighted average, and then bring it all to fruition by bringing in the debt to equity ratios to come up with the cost of equity for each business.
I have a question, actually.
Go ahead, Dan.
I was going to say, why do you think a lot of businesses are worth significantly more after a divestiture or breakup? Do you think that has to do, do you know what I'm talking about?
Well, tell me the basis. We can't state opinions as facts, right? So when you said, you're basing that starting statement on something. So tell me what you're basing it on.
I think it's a story. I forget if it was Philip Morris or Altria, but when they broke up the different divisions.
In other words, it's based on looking at companies that actually break up.
Yeah.
Right? So yeah. Why do companies break up? Because there's some friction in the process, right? In the case of Philip Morris, it's very simple. The fact that they were a tobacco company was contaminating their food businesses. They couldn't do what they could. Breaking up created value. In other words, when you look at companies that actually break up, you should expect to see those companies be more valuable after the breakup because they chose to do the breakup in the first place. But think of all the companies that didn't break up, right? I could argue that based on the evidence, that most companies are actually worth less if they break up, because if that were not the case, then most companies would be breaking up. So looking at subsamples of companies that do something, especially a divestiture or a breakup, should lead you to conclude, at least with that subset, that your value would go up because they chose to break up precisely for that reason. But there could be lots of reasons why a breakup could increase your value. It could be that by being a multi-business company, you're less efficient. By being a multi-business company, one of your businesses is poison, it's contaminated. If you're an oil company, for instance, with a consumer product arm, I would get rid of that consumer product arm right away. You know why? Because as an oil company, a lot of endowment funds can't hold your shares, your cost of equity is going to be higher. Now you're giving your food company those same penalties simply because they're attached to you. So we can talk about why in some companies breaking up is good to do, but it can't be the general rule because otherwise companies would be breaking up like crazy. So let's take Vale. I have dollar costs of equity for each of the businesses, right? But let's say I wanted to convert those dollar costs of equity into nominal reais. Why? Because, you know, I'm working with the CFO who wants to work with reais. There are two ways we can do this. One is I can start from scratch and do the whole calculation all over again. But that's a lot of work. There's a much simpler way in which you can go from one currency to another. And this is actually a technique you should keep in your back pocket because it's very effective at dealing with different currencies. Remember when we talked about different risk-free rates in different currencies? We isolated the reason as different inflation expectations in different currencies. High inflation currencies have high risk-free rates. Low inflation currencies have low risk-free rates, and deflationary currencies could have negative risk-free rates. I'm going to draw on that. I have, for instance, the US dollar cost of equity for Vale is 11.23%. That came from the previous page, the bottom. It's a bottom number, 11.23%. So I'm going to take that 11.23% as a dollar cost of equity. And then I'm going to estimate two numbers, and these are estimates, an expected inflation rate in reais and an expected inflation rate in dollars. Let's say that in 2013, those numbers were 9%. In reais and 2% in dollars. So I have 11.23% dollar cost of equity, but the inflation rate in reais is 7% higher than the inflation rate in dollars. If I'm in a hurry, you know what I could do? Add the 7% to 11.23%, my cost of equity would be 18.23%. That's a shortcut. It works reasonably well if you're in a hurry. But if you want to do it right, here's what you need to do. You need to take the ratio of inflation, 1.09 divided by 1.02, multiplied by one plus the dollar cost of capital. And if you net out one, you get a more precise answer, 18.87%. Remember the approximation was 18.23%. Doing it right will always give you a slightly higher cost of equity because there's a compounding effect. What it effectively means if you're working with a non-US company in a currency that's not the US dollar and you want to convert into a US dollar away from the US dollar, just use the inflation differential. You should be able to convert any currency discount rate into a different currency. Any questions about the currency effect? And
is that an inflation difference over like the most recent year, or is it
has to be expected? It actually is expected, and that's tricky because expected, you might use last year's number because you have no other choice, but it should be an expected number. So now let's finish off the other companies. Tata Motors is an automobile company. The fact that it's Indian automobile, I really don't care. It's a global automobile company. It owns Jaguar Land Rover. I used the beta for publicly traded automobile companies and came up with an unlevered beta of 0.86. I did consider a mild variation, and it goes back to the discretionary and non-discretionary. Jaguar Land Rover is a luxury auto company. I considered breaking Tata Motors into mass market auto and luxury auto, expecting to get a higher beta for the luxury auto. The problem I very quickly ran into is finding pure luxury automakers in 2013 was not that easy. Today it might be easier because Ferrari is publicly traded and you could probably find other publicly traded luxury auto companies. But in 2013, I didn't have enough of a sample size. So I kept it as automobiles. That unlevered beta 0.8601 is what I started with as my pure play beta for automobiles. Then I applied two numbers. One was to get a levered beta for Tata Motors, I need a debt to equity ratio. And Tata Motors' debt to equity ratio was 41%. And a tax rate, which in 2013 for India was 32.45%. So I applied Tata Motors' tax rate, Tata Motors' debt to equity ratio. The levered beta that I come up with for Tata Motors is 1.10. Global automobile company beta is the starting point, but Tata Motors' tax rate, Tata Motors' debt to equity ratio gives me a levered beta for Tata Motors. Single business company, so I didn't play any games. If I look at Baidu, single business company again, online advertising, I found 42 publicly traded online advertising companies. And again, I had to go out of China because otherwise my sample size was too small. The unlevered beta was 1.3 up and applied Baidu's tax rate and Baidu's debt to equity ratio, which is tiny, 5.23% debt to equity ratio, gives me a levered beta 1.356. If you have a single business company, things get easier because you don't have the waiting process, you can skip it. But those levered betas are what I would use to get the cost of equity for these companies. And if you look at Tata Motors, since I did everything in Indian rupee terms, I started with the risk-free rate in rupees, 6.57%. I used the levered beta 1.10. And then I used the weighted average of where Tata Motors gets its revenues to get a risk premium of 7.19%. For Baidu, my risk-free rate is a renminbi or a yuan risk-free rate. My beta is a bottom-up beta. My risk premium reflects where Baidu does business. The reason I keep saying that is I want you to get almost very comfortable with the notion that three numbers in the cost of equity, a risk-free rate, a beta, and a risk premium, each carries its own weight. The risk-free rate reflects the currency you've chosen to do the analysis in. Your beta reflects the businesses you're in and how much debt you use to fund those businesses. Your equity risk premium reflects where you do business. As long as you remember that each part carries its own weight, you're not going to get double counting or miscounting something. Everything has its place. Any questions on the Tata Motors and the Baidu example? So in both those companies, and in fact for Vale, Baidu, and Tata Motors, I had absolutely no compunctions leaving the local market and going global to get a much larger sample for my comparable companies. Which brings me to my final publicly traded company, Deutsche Bank. And as I go through the Deutsche Bank example, I want you to tell me what I'm doing. I'm going to do one thing differently here that I did not do in my other companies. And I want to see if you can catch it. So to get a beta and a cost of equity for Deutsche Bank, I broke them down into two businesses, commercial banking and investment banking. For commercial banking, I found European diversified banks. I came up with a beta for those banks. For investment banking, I went global because most investment banking in Europe is still done by commercial banks. So I had to go to UK and the US to get a lot of standalone investment banks. And I got a beta for the investment banks. So I took the beta for commercial banks and the beta for investment banks. And then I weighted those betas by just revenues. There are two things I'm doing differently here than I did with Disney. I want you to spot what's the first step. There seems to be a step that I'm skipping with Deutsche Bank's beta that I went through with Disney and Vale and Baidu and Tata Motors. What's that step that I'm skipping?
You're not considering the debt to equity.
I'm not unlevering and relevering. Ryan, why do you think that is? Why am I skipping that step?
Because capital in banks is considered raw material within the business.
Debt capital is raw material. Equity is equity. It's regulatory capital. But when banks talk about capital, it has to come from equity. Debt is raw material to a bank. And defining the debt to equity ratio for a bank is close to impossible. Try it. Pick up any bank's balance sheet. I challenge you to tell me what its debt to equity ratio is, because in a sense, everything is debt, right? The deposit you make in the bank as a customer has the characteristics of debt. With financial service companies, that's why I just go directly to the levered beta. Implicitly, I'm assuming that the debt to equity ratios for all banks are roughly the same. Because have you ever heard of an all equity funded bank? I don't even think you can have an all equity. It's impossible to do. So with banks, investment banks, insurance companies, I just go to the levered beta. Okay. And that's the step that I can do because I don't have the debt to equity ratio. So I take the weighted average of the levered betas and I come up with the cost of equity for commercial banking, investment banking. Guess what? No surprise. Investment banking is riskier. So the cost of equity for investment banking is higher than the cost of equity for commercial banking. And this is what I talked about with Bankers Trust. If you ignore that difference and you just keep putting money into whichever business the higher return equity, you're going to be taking a lot more investment banking projects than you otherwise would have. And the commercial banking is subsidizing you. Lee?
I was going to say the other thing that you're not doing.
What's the other thing?
The other thing is that you're not, in order to calculate the proportion that each business has of the company, you're not multiplying by enterprise value. Yeah.
And to be quite honest, even revenues, I'm not sure I should be doing, right? What's revenues for a bank? Now, I thought about using loans for a bank. It's for banks, figuring out something that you can use to weight the two businesses becomes trickier because banks often don't have revenues. They have interest income as their starting line, then interest expenses. They use the spread to get started. Banks are messy. Banks are really messy when it comes to trying to get. So you got to make your best judgment and move on. And you can see the two differences play out. So we've talked about Disney, we've talked about Vale, we've talked about Baidu, Tata Motors, Deutsche Bank, which leaves one business that I haven't talked about. Remember Bookscape, the privately owned independent bookstore? I'll give you a little bit of history as to how this particular company became part of this class. Long time ago, maybe 20 years ago, 25 years ago, I was sitting in my office, 5 o'clock in the evening, getting ready to go home. This lady knocks on my door and she comes in. She says, I hear you teach finance. I tried to escape by saying, no, I'm the marketing guy. But she kind of knew I taught finance. She said, I own this bookstore in uptown. And she named the bookstore. And it's a bookstore I go into all the time. I said, I love that bookstore. She said, my grandfather started the bookstore. And, it's been in the family now for 60 years. And I'm facing a fight or flee decision. My first reaction is, I'm either person, maybe you want to talk to the police in a fight or flee. And she said, no, not that kind of fight or flee. Let me tell you what's going on. She said, a new Barnes & Noble is going to open a block away from my bookstore. And I have two choices. One is I can invest the rest of my wealth, and those are exactly the words used, and this is going to become significant, the rest of my wealth back into the bookstore, putting in a cappuccino bar and whatever Barnes & Noble is offering to match it. Or I'm in a good lease and my lessor is allowed, will let me break the lease and give me $2 million to just go away because he wants to lease it to somebody else. So flee would be just shutting the bookstore down, taking the $2 million and leaving. Fight would be to take the rest of our wealth and invest it. And I said, I still don't see what you want from me. This is a big decision for you. She said, if I'm going to put the rest of my money into this bookstore, I need to know how much I need to make to break even. In other words, what kind of return should I be demanding on this investment I'm making? Do you see what she was looking for, right? She was looking for a hurdle rate. Ruth, your response might be, how the heck have you run a business for 60 years without a hurdle rate? You know how it was run? Because the original lease was done then. And once the business was started, they've never had to make big investments. So they've gone 60 years without ever confronting this question. She said, can you help me? I said, I'm a little busy right now. I have classes to teach. She said, I can give you a $200 gift certificate to the bookstore. And I love books. And I said, okay, I'll take it. I'll call you in a couple of days. So after she left, I went, I think we'd had a Bloomberg terminal installed recently, and I went and looked for book retailers, publicly traded book retailers. And I found, I think, 3 or 4 at that time. 3 or 4 is not a big enough sample. So remember the two tricks you can have when you don't get enough of a sample, you can go up and down the food chain. So I look for publishers. And that got me to about 10 firms. You're saying, is that enough? It's only a $200 gift certificate. I'm not working any harder than this. 10 is enough. I pulled up their regression betas. I did exactly what I did for Disney. I came up with an average regression beta, debt to equity, and cash. And I came up with a pure play beta for being in the book business. So far, it looks like I'm doing exactly what I did at Disney, right? Take the business, come up with betas, clean up those betas. And the pure play beta that I came up with for the book business was 0.7584. That's at bottom line. So average beta, cleaned up, corrected for cash. To now with a publicly traded company, once I come up with an unlevered beta, to get to a levered beta, I need a debt to equity ratio, right? And I need a market debt to equity. And with a publicly traded company, that's not a big deal. There is a market equity, whether I like it or not. But with a private company, I ran into a brick wall, which is I knew the unlevered beta, but I did not have a debt to equity ratio. So I called the lady back and I said, do you have a target debt to equity ratio? She said, a what? And I hung up the phone because clearly she had no idea what I was talking about. So I cheated. I said, you know, I can get a book debt to equity, but it's completely useless. But because if she had said my target debt to equity ratio is 50%, I'd have just plugged it in and moved on, but she had no idea. So I used the industry average. Those 11 companies I got the betas from, I got their debt to equity ratio. I assumed that that was the debt to equity ratio you needed to be in the book business. And I gave the debt to equity ratio to Bookscape. So here's what I have. I have the unlevered beta for bookstores. I have the debt to equity ratio for bookstores. I used the fact that her tax rate was higher than this because she paid personal taxes. She wasn't a corporation. She paid a 40% tax rate. The levered beta I came up with that 40% tax rate and the 20 and the debt to equity ratio of the business was 0.86. I'm almost there. Plugged it into my risk-free rate plus beta times equity risk premium. The equity risk premium at that time was 5.5%. Gave me a cost of equity of 7.5%. Assignment done, right? I almost called her and told her your hurdle rate is 7.5%. And then I remembered that she was a sole business owner investing, what are the words she used? The rest of her wealth back into the bookstore. Remember when you use betas, what you're assuming about company specific risk? It's all going to go away, right? Why? Because your marginal investors diversified. The minute you use betas, you've already entered that assumption. And what she's telling you, that assumption is not right in this particular case. So here's my question for you. If I plug in a beta risk-free rate and a risk premium like I have for Bookscape and come up with the cost of equity, knowing what you know, that this lady is going to have her entire wealth invested in this bookstore, not just a portion of her wealth. She's the exact opposite of a diversified investor, right? She's got everything invested in the bookstore. Do you think her cost of equity is going to be higher than 7.5 or lower than 7.5%? You see my question, the 7.5% is based on looking at only the risk you cannot diversify away. She's told you she's exposed to all risk. Lee, what do you think? Do you think she's going to see a higher cost of equity or a lower one?
I'm going to say,
Think like the owner of the business. Do you see more risk than a diversified investor or less risk?
If I were the owner of the business, I would want there to be less risk.
You want there to be less risk, but are you exposed to more risk than somebody?
I'm definitely exposed to more risk. That's for
absolutely sure. Why? Because your entire wealth is tied up in this bookstore, right? You can't wave your hands and say, well, the company specific risk is all going to get averaged out because you have an effort. So intuitively, you know what I'm pushing you towards, right? If 7.5% is your cost of equity using a market beta, given that you're exposed to all of that other risk, I would expect your cost of equity to be higher. You think that doesn't help me much? How much higher? About 30 years ago when I started investigating the cost of equity for private companies, I remember I had to give a talk to a group of private company appraisers. And I said, hey, how do you come up with cost of equity for private companies? They said, we just add 10%. I said, what? He said, we take risk-free rate plus beta times risk-free, we add 10%. I said, why 10%? He said, we call it company-specific risk. We just want a higher discount rate. And I said, that doesn't work for me. I can't just add 10% to every number. But I can understand the intuition. You want a higher cost of equity. So here's what I concocted. Notice the key word, concocted. It's not derived. It's not deep thought that went into it. I said, look, when I look at a market beta, I'm looking at only the portion of the risk that I cannot diversify away. And if you remember, when you ran those regressions to get betas, and you go back a couple of pages, you'll notice I've collected this as well. Notice the last column of the R squared for every company. What does the R squared measure? The proportion of the risk in your stock that comes to the market, right? If you look across book companies, the median R squared is about 26%. So what does it tell you? Across book companies, 26% of the variance is explained by the market, 74% by the company's own risk. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to argue that as somebody fully invested in this company, you're exposed not just to the market risk, but also the rest of the risk. So it's like an algebra problem. Basically, I'm expanding my measure of risk to include not just the risk you could have couldn't have diversified away, but the rest of the risk. I call this a total beta. It sounds fancy, but I'm just expanding the beta to bring in the rest of the risk. The way you get it is very simple. You take the market beta, which in this case is 0.86. You divide it by the correlation. The correlation is, of course, the square root of the R squared, the 0.26. And what I get as my total beta is 1.68. Instead of using the 0.86, I'm going to use the 1.68. My rationale is simple. Because you're entirely invested in this company, you're exposed to all risk, the total beta captures all risk. That much higher beta gives you a much higher cost of equity. And the number I delivered to her in return for my $200 gift certificate was about 12%. I said, your hurdle rate is about 12%. And then she asked me two questions. The first question was easy to answer. I gave her the answer. The second question I knew the answer to, but I could not think of a kind way of giving the answer. You ready? Here's what the first question was. So I led her through the process. She kind of got it. She said, okay, 12%, that makes sense. Then she asked me, well, what's Barnes and Noble's cost of equity going to be? Remember, they're a publicly traded company. They're opening a block away from me. What's their cost of equity? Teresa, what's Barnes and Noble's cost of equity going to be? They're a public company.
I would assume it's going to be a lot lower.
It's going to be about 7.5%, right? It's going to be based on the market beta. It's going to be 7, maybe 8%. Then she asked me the second question. You can see it coming. She said, if my cost of equity is 12% and their cost of equity is 7.5%, how the heck am I going to compete against them over time? And what's the honest answer to that question?
You can't.
You cannot. Why? Because you're starting at a deficit that's so deep that you can work two times as hard as a public company manager. And they do. Many private company owners do. But you're trying to make up too big a difference. So you know what happens over time? Public companies push out privately owned businesses. When I first came to the US, about when I walked into a pharmacy, you know, most pharmacies in the US were privately owned. The owner of the pharmacy was usually the person behind the counter. Today you walk into a pharmacy, anywhere in this country. What do you see if you look up? You see CVS, Duane Reade, Rite Aid. Public companies have driven out private businesses. In the book selling business, public book retailers, they even made a movie out of this, right? And Harry Met Sally, was it when Harry Met Sally? Wasn't there a movie about a private book owner? So, you know,
basically,
and they never talked about total betas. I kept waiting through the movie. When are they going to bring up the total beta concept? They kind of missed that. But in business after business, this is almost inexorable. It's not because private business owners are not efficient. It's just because they're efficient about everything else, but not about the way they take risks. They put their entire wealth into one business. And fundamentally, that is a very, very difficult place to be if you're an investor. Any questions on total betas and the kind of, you know, depth? It is kind of depressing, right? Because we all want mom and pop businesses. We want the owner behind the counter. And what this is saying is that is, you know, there's a process here that's going to drive those mom and pop businesses progressively out of business because it's not an efficient way to invest your wealth. You know? But there are some companies that hold out for a long time. Bacardi, was privately owned 300 years after it was founded. I guess if you drink enough of your product, you don't care about undiversifiable risk, total beta, et cetera. But there are some businesses that hold up, but it is holding out because what usually happens is the founder doesn't want to sell, it's their business. The next generation doesn't have as much of an attachment. As you go further and further down the chain, at some point in time, somebody says, this doesn't make sense. We should go public. We've got too much of our wealth tied up in this business. Jonathan?
Hi. My question is, suppose it's a family office where you're not fully in to the book business, but you're not also fully diversified where you have a collection of assets. How would you go about calculating
this data? Are you saying a family, an office that manages a family's wealth? Is that what you mean
by family office? Suppose instead of saying family office, a private equity office where you have a book business and then you'll have a restaurant business. How do you calculate this sort of added risk
So let's take private equity, because obviously private equity seeks to reverse this process, right? They take public companies and they make them into private businesses. If you're a KKR or Blackstone, you know how you define success on a deal? You take a public company private. But for success to manifest itself, what do you have to do? You either have to sell that private company to somebody else or take it back public. The end game here is not to keep it a private business. That defeats the whole point. So when you think about private equity investors, they're not interested in taking public companies private and keeping them private. They want to take them private, fix them, and then flip them back to the market. While they're holding it, are they exposed to more risk? Absolutely. And they try to compensate themselves with fees and other things that they collect along the way. But the process of private to public is almost impossible to stop. You know, what could potentially create a cushion is, especially in the last decade, you've had a way in which private companies have been able to raise capital as if they were public companies. You know what I'm talking about, right? Uber was able to raise capital as if it were a public company for years before it went public. So maybe there will be this gray zone in the middle where you can stay private but still be able to access public markets or public investors. But it's very difficult to stay private and run that private business entirely with your wealth because you've got too much tied up in one place. Any other questions? I promised you a shorter class today. No, go ahead.
So I guess when thinking of an example like Koch Industries,
Cargill, they tend to, in fact, the old family owned businesses in Asia and Latin America before they went public, you know how they dealt with the fact that they had everything invested in one place? I mean, take a look at in India, for instance, where I'm familiar with the family groups, the Tata Group, the Birla Group. If I asked you what businesses is the Tata Group in, you know what the answer was? They're in everything. The way they kind of dealt with it is by diversifying across businesses as a private company. Today, they don't have to do it. They're public companies. But many old family companies dealt with this risk by spreading across businesses. Coke and Cargill are different. They're different because their basic businesses, they've tried to keep low risk. So they can afford to be... But the reality is they're almost like public companies now in terms of access to capital. So I think that there are some very large private businesses, but the very fact that we can name them suggests they're more the exception rather than the rule, because it's very difficult to make an argument with anybody that the bulk of your wealth should be invested in one place. And that's okay because you're just overexposed to any movements in that investment there. Okay, so I'm going to end for today. And when we start next session, we're going to start with the cost of debt and very quickly move to the cost of capital. So I will see you on Wednesday.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you.
Professor,
yes.
What I was trying to figure out was that, okay, for, let's just check cargo and cost of equity for the company, would I basically go through the same process we did for Disney, but adjusting?
I would stay with the Disney process, not with the Bookscape process, because Now, once you get beyond a certain threshold, the owners of the company, in a sense, can figure out other ways to diversify.
Okay.
Which then makes them more like public companies.
Awesome. Thank you.
Okay.
Hey, Professor?
Yes.
You're allowed to say, find me at another time. But I have a question around convertible debt plus call spread for my company.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm doing WWE. They have a convertible debt issue instrument that's due in 2023 that is super in the money. Okay. Their stock, they see the strike price on the convert.
It's mostly options. So when you do it as a straight bond, it's a very small portion of the total value.
Yeah, it's trading at like 230 on $100 par right now. But the interesting thing is that they also have a call spread on top of it to minimize the dilution, which pushes the effective strike price for dilution up
at what price though?
It's like $31 or something like that.
Okay.
So it's 31, but stock is currently like 55. So it's still super in the money. So as I think about the amount of, for calculating the debt to equity ratio, and I think about the amount of that should be allocated to each, my assumption is that the $215 million principal value should go to the debt component, and that the in the money value
should go
above the higher strike should go to equity.
That's what I would do. Yeah.
Cool. And then, interesting argument would be, it's optional cash settlement on the it's optional cash settlement on the convert and the warrants that are the upper strike for the call spread. Mm-hmm. So if it's optional cash settlement and there is a reason to believe, and I don't have that reason right now, but if there was a reason to believe that the company would choose to cash settle instead of issuing equity, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. Yeah. That's just a dilution issue. That might be an issue you're coming up with a per share value and you're trying to estimate. So if you're doing a full-fledged going from value of equity to value per share, these might be all things that play out in what the value per share is.
Yeah.
It should matter coming up with the cost of capital.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much. It's
you're welcome.
I did converts a very long time ago and I haven't had to think about them in a bit. So this is a fun trip.
Luckily in corporate finance, you can afford to be sloppy with converts because we're not trading them. We're just breaking it down. So you might, all those features might at the margin create a 2% swing this way or that way. But for us, that's noise.
Yeah, that's kind of what I figured. All right. Well, thank you very much, Professor. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Have a great day. Bye.